The U.S. southern border with Mexico is a flashpoint in U.S. politics, and the Biden-Harris administration has committed to addressing the root causes of migration from Central America. A new report by the Population Institute details through the lens of Guatemala the important role that investments in women and girls play in a comprehensive and effective U.S. response. You're listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Population Institute President and CEO Kathleen Mogelgard and two contributors to her new report. Araceli Martinez-Rodas is Director of the Master in Development at the Universidad del Valle de Guatemala, and Dr. Joseph Spidell is Professor Emeritus at the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine, and former Director of USAID's Office of Population. The report, published just a few weeks ago, is titled Invisible Threats, Addressing the Root Causes of Migration from Guatemala by Investing in Women and Girls. Kathleen, Araceli, and Joe, thank you so much for joining us today. It's really a privilege to be able to speak to you about this new report. Kathleen, I'd love to start with you. I think, you know, there's been a lot of attention paid to this region of the world, especially in the U.S., given some of the Biden administration's recent, strategies and focuses on the U.S. southern border and thinking about what some of the root causes of migration from the region are. Can you just start by telling us about the report and what prompted it and why the focus on women and girls in particular? I think that is what sets this report apart from a lot of other great research that's come out recently.
Sure. Thank you so much, Lauren, for having us here for today and giving us an opportunity to talk about this report. As you mentioned, in recent years, there's been a growing proportion of migrants at the U.S. southern border that have come from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. And this surge of migrants has captured a great deal of political attention in the United States. And as you said, it prompted the Biden-Harris administration to release an executive order on this issue. And in February 2021, that executive order was released. It called for the development of a comprehensive regional framework to address the root causes of migration from the region. The root causes strategy came out in July of 2021. And that strategy is a fairly robust one. It notes that factors affecting migration are dynamic, complex, and interrelated and encompass a wide range of issues, including economic insecurity, governance, climate change and environmental degradation, and crime and violence. Now, for the Population Institute, as an organization that's focused on issues of gender equity and the health and rights of women and girls, we recognize that the lives of women and girls are really interwoven throughout many of these issues that are outlined in the root causes strategy. And yet what we have been seeing in the U.S. government response does not seem to raise these issues as much as we feel like they could be. We feel like it's really important to highlight how the lives of women and girls and other marginalized groups are really central to a lot of the issues that are at the root causes of migration from the region. So we wanted to draw greater attention to this and to offer a platform for partners and allies in the region to voice their perspectives and expertise on how the U.S. response could be strengthened by incorporating these viewpoints. And we were really delighted to work with a terrific team of experts from academia, from civil society, and from NGOs that are engaging in some really effective and innovative work in Guatemala. And we're hoping that the release of this report and the conversations that it will instigate will be able to really add more to the discussion of the U.S. response to root causes and really thinking about the investments that we could be making now that will help to build a more robust, human rights-based, gender-responsive approach to this comprehensive framework on addressing the root causes of migration from the region.
Joe, these are issues that you've been focused on over the span of a very long and distinguished career, including at USAID, where you directed the Office of Population and Reproductive Health. Can you walk us through some of the trends that are highlighted that you know, the Biden and Harris administration has highlighted, as Kathleen was saying, the complex connections between things like climate change and food insecurity, poverty, and governance issues, and how they are contributing to migration pressure in the region. How have you seen the focus on these trends change over the course of your career, and what's different now in the conversation, and what do you still see as missing from some of the administration's focus?
Well, I'd like to comment on a little bit on problems. Kathleen has mentioned that some of them, but also to talk about progress and successes, and maybe a little bit about potential for the future for Guatemala. Certainly, there's widespread poverty with half the population below the poverty line, and food insecurity with 50% of kids stunted. And we know that there are weak legal and governmental systems and lack of other basic services. But looking at the trend line, there's some bad and some good. I mean, the population growth has been very rapid in the past. In 1970, there were 5 million people living in Guatemala, and today it's 17.8, and the future might bring as many as 25 million in 2050, or maybe even 40 million in 2100. On the other hand, there's been considerable progress in their family planning program, and the total fertility rate, that is the average number of children each woman will have, has come down from around 5 in 1995, and it's now 2.4. And if we get down to that magic number of 2.1, then essentially we're going to have a stable population. And modern use of contraception has gone up during that same period from about 29% to about 50%. And certainly there has been ongoing degradation of life supporting natural systems. And farming is a huge mainstay of the economy of Guatemala, and a cycle of floods and drought has periodically devastated agriculture. But I like to think of the potential in terms of a country that's very similar in size, almost identical in size, and that's the Netherlands. The Netherlands has got the number two crop value in terms of exports, some over $500 billion a year, whereas Guatemala's exports are about $12 billion. And the way they've done it is through technology. And they grow using greenhouses as much on 1 acre as you can grow on 10 acres with traditional agriculture. So I think, and they're also exporting their technology. I think there's tremendous potential for Guatemala to turn things around in this regard. And the migration, well, I think it was in 2020, of 1.4 million people. I mean, that is an incredible proportion of the population. In a dozen years, there wouldn't be anybody left in Guatemala if that persisted. Now, we know some people come back, of course. And we know perhaps another favorable thing about migration is the remittances, which are very high, which help support the country. I think with regard to, you asked the original question about how things have changed with regard to foreign aid. And I think there is much greater emphasis on women's rights, women's education, and reproductive justice, where we recognize that equality is a critical aspect of the future, not just in the term of population, which of course the Population Institute focuses on, but just in general welfare.
Araceli, one of the things that stood out to me as I read the report, and going back to Joe's point about, you know, nearly 50% of the children under the age of five are stunted, that Guatemala has the largest economy in Central America and is considered an upper middle income country. But obviously there's glaring disparities if you have half the population living in poverty, and that percentage of children stunted. I think I also saw that 21% of women between the ages of 15 and 19 are pregnant or parenting. So there's definitely some structural issues going on in the country, where that sort of economic prosperity is not being shared evenly across the country. Can you share some of what those structural factors are that you see affecting migration trends in the country and poverty and insecurity?
Thank you, Lauren, of course. Okay, so maybe I will share some data from the IOM, the International Organization for Migrations. Years ago in 2017, more or less, they published the last survey on remittances. And they published some internal migration data, which was the first for our country, because of course we lack data, systematic data on migration in general, but of course on internal migration especially. So in this data, one of the causes for internal migration was the search for employment. And others were, for example, droughts or poor harvests, right? So of course, the majority of the cause of the people internally migrating were because family reunification. But when you see that the lowest percentages, employment, criminal violence, drought, poor harvests, economic problems, etc., that gives you a hint of what is going on in the territories. And of course, on internal migration, the highest percentage is on economic causes, for example, you know, searching for unemployment or better income, okay? So, but there is a little, very small percentage of point something, 0.1 or so, where climate is already being addressed. It's already being visibilized in the causes for migration. So you already have these hints of why people are being displaced. Okay, so we can talk about structural factors in around four big areas. The first is the impact of the neoliberal policies that were implemented in the 80s and 90s in Guatemala, and of course the Central American region, because it's not a particular characteristic of Guatemala, but a regional one, okay? Because of course, those policies were implemented regionally. So the neoliberal policies that weakened the state investment and the state institutions, the consequences of the internal armed conflict, which has still impacting us in, for example, dividing the society politically, or distrusting the authorities, or you know, we haven't had the opportunity to rebuild the society as was before, or at least in a more positive way, with the armed conflict destroyed. Okay, so we also have the violence and structural racism, which has many, many, many faces. And of course, the climate change effects on vulnerable populations. And this structural violence basically means that the state does not comply with the well-being of basic services, security, living conditions, et cetera. And we have these big gaps between middle-income populations and low-income populations, where the low-income populations are very vulnerable, do not have the same opportunities and the same infrastructure, for example, or the same services as others. As, for example, people living in the city, it draws back about around the rural urban populations, but also within the urban populations, we have these big gaps of people living in precarious settlements, or, you know, I don't know how to say this properly, but, you know, low income barrios or neighborhoods where services are not installed. And in this context, this year, for example, has been specifically more more straining on populations because we have more uncertainty in terms of justice, on the strength of institutions that defend human rights. There's persecution of human rights defenders, of the free press, et cetera. And we are entering an election context. So we, let's see how the next year goes. But these structural drives, drug trafficking, impact on certain territories, the organized crime, feminicide, and gender violence are also a part of these structural drives that are combined, of course, with some other factors that explain why people move. And for example, first is this historical migration flux that has been going on in Guatemala for around 70 years or so, that has allowed we have a settled population that seeks family reunification because there is this flux from the 40s with the Garifuna population starting these transnational communities in New Orleans or New York, for example. And now it's strengthened, and this allows for these migration networks in which family, friends, and community have links to their communities of origin and links to the destination places, right? And all these historical fluxes and migration networks, of course, create this migrant imaginary, so to speak, in which the effects of the remittances and digital technology, of course, have an impact on populations and communities in which the information about the benefits of migration, you know, the well-being, the prestige that a migrant can carry, all these masculinity and rites of passage that are also intertwined in the migrant imaginary, they are shared by, you know, a cell phone. So with a WhatsApp or a Facebook photo, you can see how my cousin is living in New York, and of course I want that too. So this migrant imaginary also has a part in how people decide to move, despite the hardening of the situation, of the, you know, the transit conditions and these policies, the restrictive policies that that try to detain migration, but of course it's impossible to prevent.
I mean, that you just covered a lot of ground. And I think that point about sort of capturing the imagination is a really important one, and and how sort of social media can help to promote this idealized view of what migration can be. But we also know that migration can be a really important, and has been for since the beginning of time, and an important adaptation strategy, right? And so I wonder if you could comment, Araceli, on how, you know, recognizing that for some of the population, movement is necessary, and it's an important way of strengthening both sort of the sending community's resilience, right, through remittances, through that expansion of economic opportunities. But then also recognizing that there are some people who don't want to move, but are being, you know, pushed by forces outside of their control. And so how do we think about balancing the policies that can ensure sort of safe and sanctioned movement with policies that also increase the resilience of communities on the ground so that they don't have to move if they don't want to, right? And maybe you can talk about what some of the civil society organizations are doing on the ground in Guatemala to allow people to make their own choices about whether or not they move.
Well, okay. So first, I think that NGOs in general substitute the state functions because they provide the services that the government does not supply. So especially in rural and poor territories where there's little state presence. So yes, of course, NGOs are doing a great job in these areas. And there are, for example, migration platforms that provide humanitarian aid, asylum and refugee accompaniment, and other services in the defense of the right to migrate, okay, such as Red Nacional de Protección, National Protection Network, that, for example, identify cases that need protection, help in the case referrals, make a follow-up, you know, with the institutions that are, the state institutions that are mandated to follow on cases, on asylum cases. And of course, for those migrants in transit, for example, we are having a big flow of Venezuelans, of Haitians and Hondurans, of course, Central Americans, but now the Haitians and the Venezuelans are in bigger numbers right now in the territory. And with return migrants and the communities of origin, because these platforms have a holistic perspective of work. They focus on human security and human rights. So this kind of platforms and NGOs that are working in the territories are doing a great, great job. But of course, they are connecting with national institutions, public institutions that provide the services. And how could we, or how could that work prevent or, you know, enhance the right not to migrate, of not migrating, you know, the right to stay, which is one of the rights the human rights that are these platforms also defend. The thing is that despite of the big job of the great job that these NGOs are doing, if the state or if the public services are not implemented, are not given, you know, services, infrastructure, education, security, especially, these populations do not have any other choice. And it's already more or less being documented. In some NGOs, for example, the same beneficiaries that are receiving some services, any service, are already migrating in the next year. You know, they look for them in the next year after the project closes, and they make a party or something, and they look for them the next year, and they are gone because they decided to migrate. The attraction of migration is a very, very big one. Nothing, and I am saying this with the conviction because I know that I have seen the cases. Nothing compares to the attraction of migration. The possibilities, of course, the risks are so high, of course, that you can die in transit, but the possibilities of making progress in your life actually comes from migration. So if there is nothing else in Guatemala that can give that, because many migrants are already working, for example, are already being, they work even formally in the sense that they have protected jobs, etc. But of course, they come from low-skilled jobs, and they earn the minimum wage, for example, and the possibility of earning 8 more times that salary is so attractive for migrants. So possible migrants. So of course the risks are there. They know they can die, but still, if here they cannot do anything, or they cannot progress in the way that they want, or that the cousin is doing in the States, of course they will move, even with at the risk of dying or at the risk of disappearing. And that's why the trafficking networks have been so successful in keep working and keep operating, you know, because of course there's always demand for this guidance through the route, the migration route, if there are no legal or regular forms of doing so. So besides the work that NGOs are doing, states should be lobbying for our states, Central American states should be lobbying for more temporary work permits, for example, more visas to the states, more visas on either their business or tourism. I mean, I remember one girl, especially one girl, that said, I would love to travel And of course, in a rural area, the possibilities are very low for traveling. I would like to see, you know, she told me she wanted to graduate and maybe earning something to travel, you know. And why can they travel as a tourist, as any other person could do if they have the means and they have the right to a visa, for example, unless they have to migrate irregularly. So, of course, she's a potential girl that would migrate as a worker, irregular worker, because she has no other option. And her desire was to travel, you know? So how can we combine these services that NGOs are providing with state implementation of the services that they should provide? And of course, regular means to migrate. I think that's a threefold solution or a threefold project to think about.
Kathleen, the report, sort of building on this point about strengthening the state's role, right? And in partnership with civil society and NGOs and thinking about sort of a regional approach, recognizing how interconnected these countries and territories are. One of the report's points that stood out to me was that public narratives in Guatemala overlook youth as active agents in society. And considering that half the population is under the age of 22, right? Thinking about how the state could be sort of thinking about engaging youth as active members of society, and thinking about how to create a more sort of hopeful future for those youth so that that migration is not their only option. One of the recommendations in the report is to foster greater coherence in strategies to engage youth. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure, I would be happy to say some about this, and I would love to hear Araceli's viewpoints on it as well. But that was one of the things that really stood out to me from what our authors contributed to this report, is that the approach to youth engagement in Guatemala from the state is very disjointed and uncoordinated, and tends to view youth as kind of this monolith, and does not adequately recognize the multicultural, multifaceted experiences of youth across Guatemala. And that the approach to youth then does not respond really to the needs of youth. And this is a place, again, where understanding the broader demographic trends in the region is really important. As you said, Lauren, half of the population of Guatemala is under the age of 22. So this is something that is really critical, not only to the functioning of society in Guatemala today, but will have really important implications for the decades to come in the ways in which the needs of youth are attended to in Guatemala today. So one of the things that our contributors brought out in the report is that there's not the recognition that needs to be there around the diverse experiences of youth, and particularly for youth who are seen as most vulnerable, whether that's Indigenous people, people with disabilities, youth who are living in rural communities, girls across the board, and LGBTQ youth, that there's just not the kind of nuanced approach to youth engagement that there could be. And that was one of the things that really struck me too, with a number of the NGOs that we highlight in the report are doing some really remarkable work to reach marginalized communities, to respond to youth in the ways that are required to meet their needs, and to not simply have a monolithic narrative around sort of the problem of youth in Guatemala. So programs like WINGS, for example, an NGO that is doing really remarkable work in Guatemala and various communities to engage girls and to really help them better understand their sexual and reproductive health and the opportunities for them, and to really target vulnerable girls who are coming out of situations where there is entrenched crime and poverty and instability, and offering them an opportunity to engage with one another, to find a sense of community and hope with one another, and to learn about their own lives and the rights that they ought to be able to claim in their lives. This is something that really stood out to me from the stories in the report, that groups like WINGS have been able to build communities of young people who can support one another and find reasons for hope and learn about how to advocate and claim their rights and opportunities. Funda Eco is another NGO that's doing really innovative work in conservation areas across Guatemala to work with young people, and particularly young women and girls, to better support them through scholarships to pursue an education, while also offering them reproductive health and family planning services, and pushing back against social norms around child marriage, for example. One of the stories that is told in the report is about a young woman named Myra, who was part of the scholarship program that was offered by Funda Eco. She was living in a community where child marriage was fairly common. And as she was in this scholarship program, she was promised in marriage at 15 years old. But the community that she had found and the education that she had received through this scholarship program at that point in her life made her push back against that and say, no, I do not want to be married. I have rights. And with the support of Funda Eco, was able to take her case to court. And while I know I'm hearing all of the points that Araceli is raising about weak institutions and that the state cannot always be relied upon to enforce laws in ways that protect the rights and opportunities for youth, in this particular case, they were successful. Myra was able to avoid getting married at 15 years old. She was able to complete her education. She is now enrolled in university and working to be a mentor to other young people in her community. These are individual stories, but they're very hopeful stories, I think, that give us insights into the ways that the activities of NGO and civil society can help to strengthen the response for young people, for this very large generation of young people in Guatemala, while the work is also being done to address these really major challenges around inequity in Guatemala, as well as the state weaknesses. You know, I'll refer back to the five pillars of the root causes strategy from the Biden-Harris administration. I think there is a recognition of the weakness of the state in many cases, and some of the strategies around addressing inequality, around promoting human rights, including a free press, and through addressing issues around crime and violence, and in particular, gender-based violence and domestic violence. These are all things that it's my hope that over time, this will have the result of strengthening the state, but these are long-term shifts, I think, that will occur. In the meantime, working directly with NGOs and civil society organizations who are deeply engaged in these issues and who are viewing it from a regional perspective, ways in which we can be providing greater support for this really innovative and effective work to take hold now, I think is a really valuable investment.
One of the focuses of the Biden administration has been to provide more direct localized assistance to NGOs and civil society organizations working on the ground. Araceli, do you see that happening in Guatemala? And what are some of the hurdles that need to be overcome to be more effective in that approach? I think one thing that has come out oftentimes is just the capacity of organizations to be able to receive and engage sort of with, you know, agencies like USAID to receive those funds directly.
Yeah, well, of course, funds, fund transfers are occurring, you know, but especially through the US cooperation structure. That means a USAID and other, cooperation aid institutions. And the recognized US NGOs. So it's not precisely directly to community-based organizations. And And that's an obstacle in the sense that it's not going to the territories directly, but it stay the funds stay in this middle or upper level of the cooperation cooperation structure. Of course, there are calls for projects or other initiatives, but these obstacles are in terms of bureaucracy, administrative processes, and time frames also, which are always obstacles because the call comes out, for example, today, and you need to send a proposal the end of the month. So it's very, very few days to propose something community-based in the sense that, of course, if you have this, canned produced programs, of course, it's easier. But there are limitations to community-based organizations to get these funds, to obtain these funds, to even to participate in the call. You know, and yeah, it's something that still hasn't happened. This direct localized assistance to civil society. And one of the, I remember when Kamala Harris came to Guatemala, she had a meeting with some organizations. But for example, none of the migration working organizations were invited, for example, which would have been interesting because, the migration platforms have this knowledge of what's happening in the territory, and they could have provided more insight. But of course, that was a protocol decision or whatever. But you know that kind of exclusion in the sense that community-based organizations cannot participate or have more obstacles to participate in these funds. These initiatives is something that's happening.
You know, I'd like to just throw in that I think a strong emphasis on education is critical, and this relates to many aspects of future prosperity for Guatemala. It relates to the urge to migrate. It relates to the potential to have healthier maternal and child welfare. I think that is sort of the ticket out to a modern world. And that is a place, of course, where both the NGOs and the government have an important role. In many countries, private education is important, but the government is the mainstay. And with language problems and geographical problems and stratification of society in Guatemala, this is a major challenge, but that's the one that we all ought to be supporting.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point, and that comes out in the report as well, right? This link between sort of girls' education and girls' health and access to services that allow them to continue on in school. Araceli and Kathleen, would you want to, either of you want to comment on that education piece too? And in particular, you know, I think that one, you know, Kathleen, you talked about the three examples of effective programming that we see going on in Guatemala and the focus on sort of that intersectional approach. And I wonder if maybe that can be tied into this education point, but thinking about what that intersectional approach looks like, what makes it more effective, and how do you strengthen sort of the education system and the access to education system while also thinking about those other sort of family planning and reproductive health services and how those go hand in hand when it comes to creating better opportunities for these youth.
Great. Well, I will offer a few thoughts on this, and then I would love to hear Araceli's views as well. In my view, the education piece, just as Joe has said, is a really foundational aspect of it. And I think it's, from what I understand, around challenges with education in Guatemala, the focus on girls, Indigenous communities, and other marginalized groups is really warranted because of the kinds of inequities that persist, and the ways in which childhood early enforced marriage, for example, continues to be a really deep and persistent challenge for a lot of young women and girls. And finding ways to extend education that is responsive to the differential experiences of youth in Guatemala, I think, continues to be key. One of the other programs that's highlighted in the report is a program of the Population Council, Abriendo Oportunidades, that really focuses heavily on the experience of young women and their ability to achieve an education and the supports that they need to really be able to pursue that education, and understanding how when a girl does receive an education, that opens up all kinds of other opportunities in her life that relates to a number of the kinds of factors that have been identified as root causes of migration. So in the report, we talk a little bit about the challenges around climate change and agriculture and food security. And a lot of that comes back to the status of women, particularly the status of women farmers who are doing more and more agricultural activity in Guatemala. And yet there are many barriers that would enable them, that keep them from being able to really optimize agricultural productivity, for example. This is a huge issue, and I think it gets back to what Joe was saying earlier about sort of the differences between agricultural productivity in the Netherlands and in Guatemala. When women farmers are not able, or when they're prevented from accessing credit, when they're prevented from accessing agricultural extension services, for example, agricultural productivity will not be optimized, and deep and persistent food insecurity with the resulting childhood stunting will also be more evident. So this is an area, again, that I think represents some real opportunities to better understand how the status of women and girls connects to root causes of migration, and how some really catalytic investments that help to improve women's status, help to strengthen educational opportunities for girls in their various stages of life and in their different differing circumstances, depending on where they live and the communities within which they reside, is really important to be able to have this kind of more nuanced, deeper understanding of how all of these issues intersect with one another, so that we know where there could be these kinds of catalytic investments. And once again, I'll come back to this issue of being able to uphold the examples from civil society and NGOs that are really making remarkable progress in these areas and responding to the needs of youth in terms of education and expanding opportunities. And it's something that I think the US government in its response could be paying greater attention to, perhaps engaging with more with those NGOs and civil society organizations that are making these kinds of remarkable advances, so that we could be thinking about how that could really be replicated and scaled up in ways that would have an even bigger impact.
Araceli.
Thank you. Well, I agree totally with Joe and Kathleen. I think education and this intersectional approach is very, very important. And but I would like to highlight the role of conservative lobbies here in Guatemala, and that are linked to these religious groups that prevent these programs going public, going in the public services. For example, the National Curriculum for Education has in its subjects the sexual and reproductive rights as integral sexual education, so to speak. And the conservative lobby refrained that from being taught at schools, because there's this view of pro-life, so to speak, perspective, in which if we teach the girls how to prevent pregnancies, they are going to be, you know, too loose to control, so to speak. So these conservative views on sexual reproductive education, to health services even. They belong to this machista perspective, this patriarchal view of control of the bodies of women, of course. And the role of the religious sectors, especially Protestant with neo-Pentecostal orientation, is very, very strong in communities, and they are authorities. So if NGOs do not work alongside with them, we could be, you know, adding and taking away, because any NGO can go to a community, for example, and implement a program on sexual and reproductive rights. But if the pastor of the church says it's a devil thing, a devilish thing, none will follow that program. You know, so we need to work alongside church-based, you know, sectors, the pastors, the especially evangelical neo-Pentecostal churches that are very strong now in Guatemala, and they are multiplying each day. I mean, if you see the judicial organism that allows the creation of these churches as a, you know, as an as a civil organization, it's every day is approved at least one of them. So you can see this reproduction of the churches in the communities, and of course they have authority, and they are even sometimes they have more authority than the municipality, for example. See, so we need to work with municipal services, with NGOs, with corporation agencies, but of course with religious sectors. If we forget about them, we will be doing nothing, basically, because we will have a lot of good intentions, and the programs would not be followed by girls, especially girls, which are more controlled than boys. So, and of course, these programs also should implement this alternative masculinities approach, because we are focusing only on girls, but how about the boys? And if the boys remain the same, with the same, you know, hegemonic masculinity of violence and authority and control, they will remain the same. And they will grow in the same context of violence, et cetera, trying to control women. And if women are more empowered, there will be conflict. And we need to work in a lot of ways at the same time. It's like we need doppelgangers to follow through.
Yeah, that's I was going to ask about men and boys, so I'm glad that you brought that up and thinking about the role of the importance of engaging the other half of the population, but as well as a sort of faith-based approach, and thinking about that as another institution that needs to be brought in on this and engage meaningfully. That those were all really wonderful points. Thank you, Araceli. Is there anything else missing, though, that we want to make a point about before we close?
I would just like to raise the point that I'm really grateful for all of the detail that Araceli has been able to bring to this conversation. I think it just sheds a lot of light on the ways in which our views on these issues and what we think could be done to strengthen the US government response really needs to always be engaging with voices that have the deep appreciation for that kind of nuance. I continue to learn a lot. I've learned a lot in this conversation today, and I really hope that as the US government's response and, you know, the major investment that the US government is making in the root causes strategy will continue to find ways to incorporate the voices and viewpoints of the kinds of expertise, the multifaceted expertise, and particularly voices that are cognizant of the multiple ways in which the varied lives of women and girls and the changing cultural conditions and the role of civil society and the ways in which efforts can and should be coordinated to have multiple outcomes across these intersecting issues. I really hope that we can continue to have conversations like this that bring these issues to light as the root causes strategy continues to unfold and the US government's investments in it continue to flow. I'm really grateful to be able to participate in this kind of conversation.
Well, I want to congratulate you, Kathleen, and Joe, and Araceli, and your colleagues on this report. I think that it, just like Kathleen just laid out, I think it gives a really important, it provides like a different lens into seeing the issues on the ground in Guatemala and how they are connected. And by looking at the sort of root causes strategy through the lens of women and girls' experience, I think it opens up a whole avenue of different sort of ways to engage, right? That can be more meaningful and sort of have those multiple co-benefits across the societies. So thank you very much for talking with us today, and thank you for all of the good work. And I hope that everybody listening takes a minute to read the report. I think that it has some really helpful examples too that Kathleen had touched on with some of the different work going on the ground that can really sort of illustrate the impact of focusing on women and girls. So thank you all very much.
You've been listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.